We are extremely honored today in having as our speaker Sister Belle S. Spafford, who is president not only of the Relief Society of our church, but also president of the National Council of Women of the United States. As Relief Society president, she's in charge of women's organizations in all states and many foreign countries, with a total membership of over 300,000. Chosen president of the National Council of Women in October of 1968, she presides there over approximately 16 million American women. She has just returned from Thailand, where she presided over an international conference of women. Sister Spafford, who received the BYU Distinguished Service Award in 1951 and an Honorary Doctorate of Humanities Award in 1956 from BYU, was born in Salt Lake City, received her education at the LDS University, which no longer exists, and the Normal School at the University of Utah. She taught in the Salt Lake City schools and became the grade supervisor and later the special instructor of remedial work at the BYU Training School. So we claim her here as one of our own. She was married to Willis Earl Spafford in 1921, the mother of two children. After serving on State Relief Society Board, she was called to the General Board of the Relief Society and named editor of the Relief Society magazine. She became counselor to President Amy Brown Lyman in 1940, and in 1945 became the president of the Relief Society of the Church. She has served in that capacity longer than any Relief Society president of the church. This organization, as you know, is considered the oldest active women's organization in the United States. We are privileged today to honor her as BYU's Outstanding Woman of the Year, and she will now be presented an award by Deanne Jessup, who's in charge of events for the Outstanding Women of the Year. And after this presentation, we'll be privileged to hear from Sister Spafford.
We're really grateful for the opportunity that we have of having Sister Spafford here, and we want her to know that from all the girls who worked on this quilt for, even though there were some long hours and some pricked fingers, we enjoyed every minute of it, and we're really glad that we had the opportunity to do it.
Oh, how lovely.
I merely wanted to comment that when Sister Spafford gets under that, she'll know she's at the BYU because it's blue and white.
Not only that, it has a block Y.
Now, Sister Spafford, you want this up a little?
Yes, that's fine. Now, shall I begin?
Ready.
Dr. Wilkinson and friends, I sincerely thank the Women's Academic Council of Women's Activities, I believe that's the correct name of the group, for the recognition that has been accorded me today. This is a distinct honor, which I shall always appreciate and always feel a sense of pride in having received. Coming from the Brigham Young University women, it has special meaning to me. I'm not familiar with the judging criteria that named me Woman of the Year, but I do know that for anything I may have achieved which led to this, I owe a debt of gratitude to Brigham Young University for its continuing influence over many years on my life. And certainly, I owe a deep debt of gratitude to the great church to which we belong for the guidance it has given me in my life and for the unusual and rich opportunities that it has afforded me. Now I must refer to this beautiful gift, this quilt. I know the long and tedious hours of stitching that goes into the production of such an article. I know the designing problems. I know what it means to blend the colors. And as the girls have just told you, I know the many pricked fingers and the many discouraging moments, and I know the return home from the quilting party with the aching backs. And so, to me, this gift is a very special gift, an appropriate gift, and one that I like to feel is a gift of love as well as a work of art. Now, I love the women of the church, and I try to serve them to the best of my ability. I try to uphold them. I often find myself overly ready to speak in their defense if I feel that they are being slighted in the least or not given the opportunities and attention which I feel they merit. I'm inclined to think that some of the brethren are beginning to realize this, pay a little attention to it. Because just a few days ago, I was in a meeting with a group of the general authorities on some very discouraging social problems, and a paper was passed to each of us on which was listed the number, not the names, the number of persons in the penitentiary. They listed the sex, they listed the age groupings, they listed the type of crime, and they listed the period of incarceration. And one of the brethren looked over his paper rather carefully, and then he said somberly, "Well, I notice there's only three women listed. I don't think Sister Spafford's going to like that. She'll call it discrimination." Speaking seriously, however, I seek only that the women shall be properly considered and allowed to function fully in the spheres divinely assigned to them as women. And I know of no organization that does this with greater integrity than does our church. In it, women are accorded a position of great dignity, great responsibility and trust, and they are given rich and unlimited opportunities within the range of their capacities and training. It is mainly about the women I wish to speak today. And notice I said about the women. I realize, Dr. Wilkinson, that there are many men here, but I can't conceive of a group of this kind where there aren't a few men a little bit interested in hearing about women. Latter-day Saint doctrine teaches us that men and women have a common destiny, which as free agents they may attain or lose through their individual actions. The late Dr. John A. Widtsoe maintained that the restored gospel brushed aside for all time the age-old controversy of woman's rights versus man's rights. The restored gospel has given to women her full rights of suffrage. Woman was given the religious vote with the founding of the church at a time when few men and no women enjoyed this privilege. In a revelation given to the prophet Joseph Smith in July 1830, just 4 months after the church was organized, the Lord reaffirmed the principle of common consent in church affairs, saying, and I quote from the Doctrine and Covenants, "And all things shall be done by common consent in my church." Church teachings recognize woman's equal mental powers with those of man and her right to use her inborn talents to the full. And the church, as I have said earlier, affords her the opportunity to do this. This equality recognized by the church does not ignore the natural differences between man and woman. There is a divinely ordained division of labor for forming, maintaining, and protecting the unit of society known as the family. And there is also a divine decree that the presiding officer shall be the husband and the father. Also in the church, there is decreed by divine law that priesthood or men shall administer the divine laws. In the family, both man and woman is blessed by this division of labor, just as they are in the church. Women enjoy all of the blessings of priesthood, just as do the men. These divisions also recognize the work assigned to each. Women have their work in building the kingdom, just as men have their work. And I think there is no intelligent woman who would wish to have it otherwise. Only 12 short years after the church was organized, the Lord, through revelation to the prophet Joseph Smith, gave to the women of the church an organization. Now we call it the Relief Society. The brethren refer to it as a companion organization to the priesthood, through which the women might express themselves, develop their potential as women, and do the woman's part in building the work of the church. Both as such a thing as an organization for women at that time was greatly at variance with prevailing viewpoints and practices. Less than 10 years earlier, after Relief Society was organized, a few bold women formed the first woman's club. It had a political purpose. It was called the Philadelphia Female Anti-Slavery Society. The furor which this aroused is described in a book titled Angels and Amazons, issued by the National Council of Women of the United States in 1935. It states that the woman who identified herself with this group was regarded as bold and unwise indeed, for a respectable woman did not speak in public, nor did she organize in behalf of any cause, let alone a political cause. At the first convention held by this group, a mob roared outside the meeting place, and following the meeting, the building was set afire and burned. With such conditions extant, came the light of the gospel, dispelling darkness, injustice, and bigotry, and glorifying woman as a beloved daughter of our Heavenly Father with a divinely ordained mission in earth life. It opened for her endless doors of opportunity. At an early meeting of the society in Nauvoo, the prophet addressed the sisters. He spoke of delivering the keys of the priesthood to the men of the church. He admonished the sisters as to their responsibilities, and then he said, "I now turn the key in your behalf in the name of the Lord, and this society shall rejoice, and knowledge and intelligence shall flow down from this time henceforth." It is my conviction that in this pronouncement he turned the key not alone for Latter-day Saint women, but for all womankind. For in organizing the Relief Society, the prophet established what we refer to today as an open-door membership policy, confining membership not alone to Latter-day Saint women, but extending it to all women free from censure. The turning of the key for women by the prophet was, in my judgment, the initiatory action that made possible the opening of the great so-called woman's movement of the world. 6 years after these words were uttered by the prophet, the first Woman's Rights Convention was held at Seneca Falls, New York. It was practically a small assembly of neighbors, but it thrashed out the first public Declaration of Independence for women, calling for equal educational, social, industrial, and political rights. The women worked long and hard for suffrage, seeing in it the open door for social and political usefulness. There are still a few countries in which this has not yet been achieved. It was granted in the United States in 1920 through the adoption of the 19th Amendment to the Constitution. It appears to me that the so-called women's movement has fallen into three distinct periods. First, the struggle for suffrage and a recognition of women's rights. Second, a period of awakening on the part of women to the fact that with privilege comes its concomitant responsibility, and that in meeting her responsibility, woman must prepare herself through education, training, and experience. In 1954, in an international conference in Helsinki, I heard the president of the International Council of Women, Dr. Jean Adar, chide the women of the world because they had done so little with the freedom of suffrage they had worked so hard to gain. And then she accused them of not being prepared, and that this was the reason why they had done so little. She challenged them to use the next 15 years to prepare themselves to make a qualified contribution to life. Now, this is the third period. And this period is a period of action. A period when woman sees herself not only as a woman with rights and responsibilities, but she sees herself as a citizen, obligated and capable of dealing competently with home and community life. Women today are concerned with and are making their contribution to the same grave national and international issues as our men. I have noted with interest that at the two large recent National Council of Women conferences which I have conducted, that there have been in attendance a comparatively large number of distinguished men. Among the speakers have been top authorities, both men and women. One conference dealt with reform in the Electoral College. The other, our common concern, the crisis in human environment. There was a time when men wouldn't have been seen at a woman's conference, nor would the women have admitted them had they come. Today, the tendency is to join hands in community betterment. While there are a few women who hold positions of power today, it is my opinion that in world and national affairs, women rule in the main by influence, while men rule by power. I recall at one time when I first served in the Relief Society presidency, the ward had built a new meeting house, and they had to raise a few thousand dollars more in order to have it dedicated on the date scheduled. Relief Society was called upon to prepare and serve a turkey dinner to a large group. It was the first dinner in the new meeting house. We found the kitchen to be insufferably small. The women were in each other's way, slowing up the service. One woman fainted with the heat. The next day, in distress over this circumstance, I went to see the bishop. I explained the situation and I requested that they knock out one wall and extend the kitchen to include the adjoining space, which had been allocated to a classroom. He responded with sharpness. "Certainly not," he said. "We aren't going to start remodeling this building before it's dedicated." And he summarily dismissed me. On my way home, discouraged and feeling somewhat reprimanded, I called at the home of one of the older sisters, and I tell you, I poured forth my troubles. I concluded by saying, "In this church, men have all the power. The women are just helpless." To this, she replied, "Oh, no, my dear, the women are not helpless." Then she added, "If someone came to you, Sister Spafford, and had a good but different gift in each hand, and one was power and the other was influence, and you had a choice, which gift would you choose?" I thought of this seriously for a moment, and then I said, "Well, I think I would choose influence." "You did, my dear," she said. "Influence is the great gift of God to women." Then she said, "Appreciate it and use it aright. Do not covet that which has been given to the brethren." This was a great lesson which I have never forgotten. And I commend it to you young women, in your companionships, in your homes, and in your church and community life. I have just returned from attending, in company with Sister Florence Jacobson of the YWMIA, a 2 weeks conference of the International Council of Women held in Bangkok. The conference was sponsored by Her Royal Highness the Queen. The invitation was extended to the world women by the princess, the royal princess. There were approximately 400 women in attendance, representing national councils of 64 free nations. 3 new councils were admitted to membership during the conference: Nepal, Madagascar, and Turkey. So important did Nepal regard this convention that the one representative from this country walked 35 miles carrying her bags from her place of residence to the airport, where she could get a plane to take her to Bangkok. 2 Russian women were admitted to the conference as observers. Now, heretofore, they have never admitted Russian women. The Russian women have an organization comparable in structure to the International Council of Women, known as WIDF, Women's International Democratic Federation. These 2 councils, the National Council of Women of the International Council of Women and WIDF, are the only 2 women's organizations with consultative status in the UN. And I assure you that their power and influence is immeasurable through this body. It was my privilege as president of the National Council of Women of the United States to serve as chairman of our 20-woman delegation. Since voting is done by unit rule, it was my responsibility to cast all votes for the United States Council, often making my decision as to how to vote independent of group counsel. This was a rich experience, but an exacting and difficult duty. I learned one thing from this experience, if I learned nothing more, and that is the value of patience and the value of restraint in leadership. The delegates to the International Council of Women Conference on the whole were women of stature, members of parliaments of their respective countries, university presidents, and other prominent educators, scientists, doctors, lawyers, women with other types of professional training. They were informed women with intense feelings. They were vocal and courageous in their viewpoints. The theme of the conference was living amid change. The conference called upon the women to look backward at the good things of the past, to properly assess the present, and then to move forward with courage. Discussion centered around such important issues as, and on these issues I can only enumerate them, to give you an idea of the scope of interests of the women. I wish I had time to give you a little idea of some of the discussions. One was patterns for peace and the avoidance of conflict. This was perhaps the most discouraging of all discussions, dealing not only with Vietnam, but also with the Middle East, disarmament, the United States' position on the ABM and MIRV systems. The final draft of the resolution on peace, in my judgment, was almost meaningless. Certainly, it was without teeth. But I couldn't see how the women could have been brought to a common mind, so at variance were their national interests. Discussion included the improvement of international relations, the status of women in law and its improvement in practice, strengthening the stabilizing influences of the family as the foremost social institution, education, the need for drastic revisions in the elementary, secondary, and college levels to meet present-day living. Since returning home, I have been advised by letter that a special task force under the aegis of Robert Finch, Secretary of United States Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, has been charged with developing proposals for new structures in United States higher education. Mrs. Audrey C. Cohen, the only woman on the task force, has been named president. In writing to me, she said it is her intention to put forward some new and radical ideas regarding the education of women. She has requested that I contribute my thinking to this subject. Now, I do not hesitate to say to you that having heard some of the discussions at the International Council Conference, I fear the use of the term radical. The section on education also dealt with literacy and the need, the urgency, in fact, of writing for the newly literate. Environmental problems received considerable attention: air and water pollution, their sources and control, waste removal, the conservation of natural and man-made resources, the dangers of overuse of pesticides, health and national medical programs was debated, food production, nutrition, population growth were considered. The Council's responsibility to modern mobility of people from rural to urban life and across frontiers demanded attention, as did the urban scene, its problems, their causes, and treatment plans. The communication media, the press, radio, TV, and films, was an engaging subject as values and evils were debated, along with what woman must stand for in enlarging the values and curbing the evils. Leadership for the future, youth activities and training held an important place in the concluding sessions of the conference. Running through it all was the role of the councils in national development and international goodwill. Over and over again, I heard the term the council as catalyst. The discussion of these subjects led into a consideration of such delicate and controversial matters as divorce laws, birth control. They tell me 2 children is all any family should have. Sex education in the schools, sexual promiscuity and its effect on the individual, the home, and society, unrestricted abortions, the working mother, income tax exemption for the working mother, the establishment of free nurseries for preschool-age children, the better control of crime and delinquency with more effective law enforcement, legislation to ensure the legal rights of children born out of wedlock, drugs, their use and control, together with treatment of the addict. The false image of women today, as created by advertising of commercial items and through all forms of media, the curbing of pornographic publications, scenes of violence, nudity, and sex in films. Then came one great issue, freedom of the press, and it was hotly debated. What does it mean, they asked, and what is its responsibility toward self-imposed restraints? Or should we have an absolutely free press that we may have an informed people, the women asked. In these matters, I found myself deeply grateful for the teachings and guidance of the Church. Through them, we have light on controversial matters not vouchsafed to others. As the conference progressed, I realized that this is indeed a troubled world. As I listened to some of the viewpoints and opinions, I felt there was a need to have come ringing down through the ages the echoing voice of Moses from Mount Sinai when he declared the Lord's Ten Commandments, commandments that have never been rescinded. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. Thou shalt not covet anything that is thy neighbor's. The conference impressed me with the fact that human needs and aspirations are pretty much the same the world over. Differences lie in the traditions of the respective countries, in their cultures, in their degree of development, and their national political interests. National political interests are particularly strong. Personally, I was somewhat disillusioned and disappointed at times to see brilliant, purposeful women, women seeking to make the world a better place, resort to action which I regarded as a sacrifice of principle to expediency or to national advantage or to personal ambition and power. To me, integrity is not a marketable commodity. It should neither be sold, bartered, nor sacrificed. I saw more clearly the problems faced by our own national leaders in their international relationships. Now, to you young women and men alike, today I say you are living in a troubled world. Its problems will not all be resolved by today's leadership, competent as some of it may be, for they are too many and too deep-seated, and viewpoints in too many instances are beclouded with false concepts and erroneous standards of right. Problems will yield, to some extent, there is no doubt, but they will not be overcome. To you, we turn with hope. The trained, straight-thinking leaders of tomorrow. The best advice that I can give to you is to take full advantage of your educational and leadership opportunities and cling fast to the Church and its teachings. In the restored gospel is found truth. There is found teachings which build character. And there is found the correct plan for good living and the only sure road to peace, prosperity, and happiness, either for the individual or for the nations of the world. May the Lord bless you to this end. I pray in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.